Wednesday morning at 8:35. Good morning. Stop. Now, I'm closer to the mic here, so let me get a better break. The mic is right here. This is Wednesday the 19th, and this is a test with our guest. Let's see how it goes. Okay. We're now recording.
Excellent.
Recording. We have Marge and Lloyd and Jim here on the 19th of May in Pittsburgh, and you had some questions, like 150.
The 19th of December in 2001.
Right.
And we're here to hear Jim.
Good and loud.
We're here to talk to Jim Fisher's memories about his memories of the Fisher Collection of Chemical Arts and his memories of his father and of the artworks. So, Jim. I wanted to start out talking to you about your childhood, who your family members were, their names, your parents' names, the names of your siblings, any extended family members that you think should be mentioned and that were involved and loved the artworks that we now have in our collection.
Well, the Fisher Collection, some of which is art and some of which is copies and some photographs and drawings and could or couldn't be described as art. Matt and Dad always referred to it as the Fisher Collection. The company was always referred to as the Fisher Collection of Alchemical and Historical Pictures. And Dad was not nearly so much interested as to whether it was art, so long as it had a scientific connection. That's why he started it. Now, to go back to your question, Mother was Margaret R. Aiken, A-I-K-E-N, which is my middle name, and also the first name of my oldest brother. Both of our brothers are deceased now. And her family was Scott-Irish, from what is now called Northside Pittsburgh, an area originally called Allegheny City, and originally the second or third largest city in Pennsylvania, now a part of the city of Pittsburgh. Father came from a German family, and his grandfather spelled his name with a C, which is the only way you can spell Fisher in German. There is no SH in German, it's SCH. So when grandfather came to this country in about 1840, he took the C out because he thought making it F-I-S-H-E-R was more, quote, American. He changed Johann to John, so he became John Fisher, and he had a C left over. Because he took it out, so he put it in his middle initial, and it made him John C. Fisher. And he was just the man who saved everything, and he didn't want to have a C lying around left over, so he made a middle initial out. That was a very common heritage, a Scottish and German. Believe it or not, that was in this area was a very common marriage get together. The Scottish troops came into Pittsburgh with John Forbes in 1758, the Scottish troops under John Forbes, who was Scottish, came in and captured Fort Duquesne from the French and Indians. Duquesne was the French governor of Canada, then called New France. And they saw a large group of troops coming in and knew that they were going to be defeated, so they abandoned the fort, set fire to it, and left. So it was kind of a hollow victory, but didn't make any difference. The British got it anyway. When those Scottish troops, quote, captured the fort, if you want to give them credit. In baseball, they say you get credit for the win. A lot of the Scottish troops stayed in this area. So you had original Scottish settlement, small. Here. And they sent for wives and sisters. And then when the Germans came in sometime later, 40, 50 years later, a huge German invasion. So you had that part of the city thickly populated by Scottish and German people. We had 11 breweries over in that part of the city, Allegheny City, now called Northside. And there were German singing groups and bands and German clubs and the Rathskellers, and it was very, very German. Then Dad came from that heritage, and they met as young people. Dad saw Mother sitting in a box at a theater, a just startlingly handsome woman with thick black wavy hair, very handsome young woman. I think she was perhaps 20 at the time. And he decided he would meet her at intermission, and so he went up to her and introduced himself. And they courted and were married in 1905. And the first son, my brother Aiken, was born in 08. So that's how the family got started. I am chasing down both sides of the family through a genealogist and the urgings of my children.
Wonderful.
And so I'm doing a tree and all that sort of stuff. And the oldest brother was Aiken. He was born in 08. My father was a very methodical man. And this is all in the tape you heard, Lloyd, except they didn't let you hear it, which is too bad. Anyway, Dad was a very methodical man. He graduated in college. He was born in 80, which is nice and neat. He graduated from the University of Pittsburgh, then called Western University of Pennsylvania, in 00, keeping it nice and neat. And his four sons, there were no daughters, the four sons were born exactly 4 years apart in 8, 12, 16, and 20. And they were all boys that were exactly 4 years apart within a month.
Wow.
Now, the family members were involved with the collection only through business. Because the Fisher collection really stayed in the business. It didn't come home. We never had anything from the Fisher collection hanging in the house where I was born, where all of us were born. Naturally, we knew about it because one son died in infancy, but the three, which I'm remaining, all worked in the business right after graduation from college. The oldest brother, Aiken, graduated in 29 and went to work for the company. We'd all worked there in summers before. And another brother graduated from college in 38. And went right to work there. I graduated in LA. Actually, Pearl Harbor came along, and I graduated early. I was class of 42, but got out in late 41 or very early 42, because, of course, Pearl Harbor had been attacked, and worked for Alcoa, Aluminum Company of America, working in what you might today call a smelter plant, a plant that turns ore into aluminum, which is badly needed, of course, for warplanes. And following the war, end of 44, early 45, I left Alcoa and went to work for the company. So eventually we all worked for the company. And when you worked for the company, you had to be aware of the Fisher collection because it was hung all over the offices.
Right.
And it was rather indiscriminate because wherever you had a wall, Dad had something hung there. And the people who worked in the company was pretty small in those early days, took quite an interest in it because, you know, hanging right over their desk or right next to their desk was a couple of old alchemists blowing up some ancient laboratory. They couldn't help but notice it. But the collection and the company were inseparable. And of course, Dad was the inspiration for it. I've been trying to think when I got you early. Dad began collecting, I believe, right after World War I, which, of course, ended in 1918. And that war started in 1914, and the source was Europe. There was no other source, really. So I don't think there was any collection before 1914. The company was only 12 years old.
Right.
And Dad had his hands full with 3, 4, 5, 6 employees. It started with 2, as you know. And I don't think he did any... I don't think he'd been to Europe. I don't believe he'd made a European trip. which wasn't essential, but it was useful in tracking down the dealer who had such a narrow interest.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Most of these pictures were bought through a dealer who had a very specific and focused interest in a few things.
You have no memory or knowledge of who that dealer was?
Oh, it's in the records. Some of the records I've tried to chase down, and Harry Schwalden, you can call later if he's in town. I have his on this number here.
Oh, that would be great.
And I don't think he has a recollection of who the dealers were. But the towns were London, Paris, Brussels, the heart of the Flemish painting, of course, and a lot of these rather fine works that really are artworks as well as historical were Flemish.
Yes.
As Netherlands and
yes.
Belgium. And let me see, maybe a dealer in Germany somewhere. I don't recollect which city. But those were the prime sources, these three or four dealers. And those dealers, as you know, are amazing. They can kind of smell something. And they trade information from dealer to dealer because one has a customer who has a certain interest and he trades it with another dealer who has a different interest. And that way they move stuff.
That's right. They support each other.
That's right. They do. And that's so. My best guess is Dad took an interest in about 1920 would be my first guess. And what tricked it off and what triggered it, I don't know. It might be that he made a trip to Europe in the 20s. I know he did. But it might have been the early 20s because he and mother went fairly often to Europe on steamship, of course. And always Cunard Line. That was reliable because you could trust the English. Also, there was no language problem. There was a language problem on a ship anyway because they always have a multilingual crew. But mother was zero linguist. Dad spoke a little German because his grandfather and mother were German, you see. And they would sing some German songs when I was a kid at Christmas time. O Tannenbaum,
Old
Christmas tree.
Oh.
And they had a few little tiny jokes in German. My grandmother, who lived to be almost 90, obviously was pretty good in German. So they went to Europe, and I think that's how Dad at first may have got the idea. I don't know what sparked the original thought, but he began to take an interest and ask about dealers. And, of course, dealers were happy to...
Sure.
All Americans were considered rich, and you're American. I mean, that was big stuff. And they would make a record of what he was interested in and send him photographs. And
so they sent him photographs?
Very often.
I see.
And then as he became better established and known to them, they always paid his bills very promptly.
Yes.
And incidentally, he made this collection himself, and he paid for it himself. Much later, the company bought it to get it out of his estate.
Oh.
He must have been in his late 70s.
Oh, really?
Early 80s. He died when he was 84. But oldest brother Aiken, a very, very wise man, extraordinarily wise man, he was a think-ahead guy. And he knew that some federal appraiser could put a value that was complete nonsense. Because he didn't understand it, so you just put a,
right.
X million bucks or whatever.
Right.
So he had the company buy the collection, and that, of course, took it at a reasonable price, a very modest price. And then that all just became buried. That was all history, and the
right.
company owned it. So it wasn't in Dad's estate. And when the company was sold, and I was out of the company, had I been there, I think I would have thought of it. When the company was sold, they made the mistake of selling the collection with
right.
And that was a mistake
right.
because then it bounced all around the place.
Right.
And
thank
it was
goodness
in terrible
you
shape.
That down.
Good morning.
Just dump it over there, please.
Sure,
thank you very much. Excuse me, there's a mailman coming. I'll lock the door. That's my guess as to how we got started.
So your dad must have had incredible files and records if he received photographs. And from these dealers,
he did.
Did he pay some, do you think?
Well, You see, when the company was sold, I wasn't in the company.
Yeah.
And Ben and Aiken had relatively little interest in the collection. I was the one that took over with the interest. I bought the number of works.
Yes.
After Dad died in 65. Yes, he died in 1965. So I became the one who became interested in it. And when the company was sold, I wasn't in the company. I had been let go in a separation agreement with, we had an altercation with the then president. And so I had no idea what happened to those records. You see, another company came in and just took over the whole, and they had absolutely no appreciation of what they had. They didn't even know what they had.
So where's Harry Schwab fit into this, and John Pavlik?
Well, Harry Schwab was the original self-appointed curator. And he got to be that because we used our collection of alchemical and historical pictures as part of our advertising and public relations program. And he was a writer that I had hired for the advertising department.
Oh.
I was vice president of marketing. And that meant sales promotion, direct mail, catalogs, publications, sales training. We did our own printing. We owned our own ad agency. I don't know, a lot of things.
Right.
And Harry was a writer in the advertising department, which acted like an advertising agency, but really a department of the company. And Harry was a walk-in, and I hired him, and he showed me what he could do in 10 minutes, and I hired him. And he wrote a publication. He wrote a lot of publications for us. And the publication he first worked on was one that Dad had started. And we used an alchemical picture of some sort, or one from the collection, on the front cover.
Mm.
The way Life magazine always had a full-bleed front cover picture. Look did the same thing for a while. And so it was kind of the trademark or style of the publication, which was called The Laboratory.
What date would that have been that the first picture was used? Do you have a recollection?
Well, it would be very early in the issue of the first Laboratory. Schwab would know the dates of that.
Mm-hmm.
The company and John Pavlik would know the dates, because they had a complete collection of every issue of The Laboratory.
Is there any chance that there's an extra collection that we could add to our archives, an extra set of these?
Oh, we're lucky to get one set of The Laboratory. You know, Marge, it's very funny. When history is happening, so very, very, very few people realize it's happening.
Sure. That's normal.
And I expected to work till I was 75 or something at the company.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I might survive the brothers, which I have. And I didn't know whether it was family owned, and they let me have a little cubicle in the corner or something so I could, you know, collect my mail and come in a couple of days a week, like Dad did. Mm-hmm. He tapered off. Mm-hmm. And I would have kept an interest in history, but you see, all of a sudden I wasn't there.
Yes.
I left the company in 1979.
Oh.
And so, and all of this mess happened later. Excuse me. So there was no duplicate. In the 50s, one could have set up a duplicate copy of The Laboratory, because you could dig around and find every one that had been published for, 35 years, I think. John can answer that. We can call him if he's in town. And, of course, Harry would answer that.
Of course, Xeroxes would be perfectly acceptable for us. And we can look into that later.
Well, there is a complete...
As a research record.
There is a complete set of The Laboratory.
Yes.
35, 40 years. And then it stopped. Just stopped. And as you know, it stopped, and people thought they were paying for it as a periodical. They kept writing and saying, my subscription has run out.
Well, you see how good a job this advertising did. I can't believe how many people remember.
It was
these
a.
There's
a company history here on the table, and I'll find it. And I gave it, it was written for a business. It was written by Fisher. scientific, public relations, and it was written for as a hope to get it into, well, the Wall Street Journal, because we're 100 years old in May, as you know, and sometimes the journal will go for it. One of those family companies survives 100 years and still doing what it was doing when it set out, which is very unusual because, you know, you started out to make buggy whips, and now you're making computers. It's the same company. But here's a company that set out to do laboratory equipment supply, and today is the largest in the world doing laboratory equipment and supplies. And so that may have a little what's called a news hook that would appeal to the journal. So Norm Ritter at Fisher is doing that, and I'll find it for him. And he wrote and I rewrote and he wrote and I rewrote a mini history of the company.
Great.
For the publication. Also, I have here for you the Fisher News, which is an internal newspaper for employees when it was 70 years of age.
Great.
So that is useful to you.
Yes.
So we're just guessing as to when the first alchemical pictures were started to become, but probably in the 20s, probably as a result of traveling to Europe. But something crossed Dad's mind that he could dignify and therefore cultivate the scientists by this collection. And the collection was kind of homage to science, who was largely unrecognized. He was the man behind the guns. Way down in the dumps was a lab somewhere. And the steel manufacturers, they got all the pizzazz up front. It was glamorous, and these huge rolls of steel came in. But, of course, every roll had to be tested, and way back somewhere,
there was
down the hospital corridor in the cellar, was a lab,
etc.
So his customers, therefore, were the unglamorous, the unrecognized, the unappreciated people. And until the atom bomb and the attack on Japan, you remember President Truman came out with a speech, "We have won the battle of the laboratories as we have won the other battles," announcing the victory over Japan. That was the headline in every newspaper, and I don't know whether television was in effect at that time, maybe not, but that was the headline.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden people said, listen, the battle of the laboratories, and the word laboratory suddenly began to take on significance.
Yeah. Yes.
The whole Manhattan Project,
right,
and atomic energy,
charisma,
all came out of the lab. And so suddenly it wasn't confused with laboratory, which it was for years. And in the story I can't find,
we had that
visitors to the house, and this was in my speech.
Yes.
You didn't hear it. But when you get to Philadelphia, you can hear the speech. And Mother's house was kind of a curiosity because if you could be invited, you could ask to use the bathroom, because it was just an ordinary bathroom, even though he was in laboratory supplies. So that's how it started, and it started very small. And after a certain number of issues, which is recorded in the laboratory, he began to put the parts of the collection on the front cover. Up to that point, the front cover was all print.
I see.
It had maybe four lines of like little headlines. And, he wrote that for years before I took over. And they were interesting headlines. You know, he put a little spark in them. They weren't just dull.
Sure.
But it wasn't nearly as interesting as having some old poop, in the middle of the 17th century blowing up a big cauldron of something
right.
on the front cover. I mean, that was intriguing.
Oh, right.
So he began to put those on the front cover. And
what about the posters? When did they
start?
Well,
they came in a good bit later, the reproductions. He waited quite a while. I believe we started the reproductions in both color and black and white probably around 1950.
Mm-hmm.
I believe so, because when I went with the company after the war, let's call it 45. I don't recollect that we offered the reproductions then. Now, a search of the catalogs, of which I have many, could document that because we began to list those reproductions in our regular catalog, which is, as you know, hundreds and even thousands of pages. And we did some smart things. I don't know who did this. Maybe I did. We assigned numbers to the 7 or 8 black and white reproductions as B1, B2, and the colored one says A1, A2, A3. Now, what that was done was to avoid complication, but it was also done so that the laboratory or stockroom man could, on a requisition list, put down 2-540 beakers, one case of 10-040 flasks, 2 A1.
They
he got
right
two colored prints.
The,
you see, went right through the purchasing department.
Right.
The print department didn't know what it was. They took the requisition,
yeah,
and
yeah,
it was all approved to set the order through. So
I
when
see.
This box arrived at the lab, it had all the thermometers and chemicals and more, and a couple of pictures were in there, too. And
oh,
they were offered
great.
Framed and unframed.
That's great.
And I've forgotten what the designation was for framed or unframed.
Yeah, yeah.
But they all had a number, and that helped us. Of course, the stock boys, they much prefer to work by numbers. You know, do you want a 2-540-400? That's a
right, they don't care.
Griffin Beaker, mm-hmm, 400 Melvies.
Mm-hmm.
And same with that says A1 framed was A1 framed. They're all pre-cartoned and
right,
put it in the box with all the rest of the stuff.
Right.
So that's when it began to become very popular. We also put salesmen on a quota. Everybody had they go wild if you let them go, you know, they'd say, send me 200.
Yes.
And they cost quite a bit. Framed, especially framed. So a salesman was given a quota, I don't know what it was, a few, a dozen or so a year, whatever. And he would pick selected customers. And then one fine day, he would go into the chief chemist and they would do their business and so forth. And then he'd say, Dr. Jones, I have something here for you I think you would enjoy. And he'd hand him B1 or A1 or whatever. Oh, I was very flattered to have it.
Sure.
And the other smart thing was, when it started out, it was a little bit advertising-like. It had a good bit more print about the company on it than I thought was smart. I wanted to play this down because I wanted it to get on walls and people kind of, if you put too much advertising on there, they're going to kind of react.
Right.
So I had in very light type on there, and it's there today, I believe.
I thought it was quite discreet.
Something from, reprinted with permission from the Fisher Collection. That's all it says.
I think it's quite discreet.
And it's very light. Uh-huh. And it says Fisher Collection. It doesn't even say Fisher Scientific Company.
I know.
And that's enough.
I thought that
now,
was
the
smart.
Nice thing about that is, and this is in the tape they didn't let you hear, is that when the chief chemist was promoted or retired or died or moved or whatever, the new chief chemist, which was probably his assistant, moved into the lab, into the same lab office, and there was the picture on the wall. Well, why was he going to move it? He was glorifying it.
Right.
So it drove our competitors nuts because there was the darn thing hanging on the wall, no matter who was the chief chemist, it just kept changing. But it was a brilliant idea of Dad's and just turned into a kind of a icon associated with the company. It became
absolutely
very closely associated with the company.
Absolutely.
It wasn't unique. There was a chemical company in Detroit that had run by a guy named Bayer.
Right.
And he had some alchemical pictures, some really quite good original oil paintings.
Yes.
Half a dozen, I think.
Many of his were religious, though. They were they were not many that were chemical.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that. He was in the chemical business. And
right,
you think, but you see, when he went around to try and buy them, there weren't a whole lot left because Dad had been at this for years. And he used them on his little publication. There's a little advertising publication.
Right. I think it is.
And he became associated with his company.
Aldrich Gilmer.
He would often write story about it because he was very, Alfred is very interested in art history, and he's become an art dealer now.
Oh, really? He became an art dealer?
Yes, in 17th century Dutch art. He was also forced out of his company and has taken this up as a second career, and he's become the world's greatest dealers of Rembrandt.
Oh, no kidding. You've got to be good at that game, boy.
And he's famous for his eye.
I see.
Very
admirable. I'm amazed it hasn't been printed. But you will come on this recorder, and I'm telling you the right of man, so that it comes out of your head.
That's right, it's off. It's all the way off.
I don't know, it must not be audible.
I don't know why, except before it rains. But my fax machine doesn't work either this morning. It's quite bad, you know. I have to take it inside. Fisher. Go ahead, Linda. Yeah, right.
It's okay. That's fine.
Go ahead and do it.
Thank you. Sorry. This should answer, and I don't know why. Yeah.
That's fine, no problem.
Well, we're very interested in seeing if Alfred, I'm sure Alfred must have been inspired by
Chen.
Well, sure he was. I'll come across that thing I'm doing for somebody else.
That's great.
Save you, and I'll find it. Well, let's see. That's how we got into it, and that's how he started to use it for public relations, advertising, whichever you prefer. And, which brings me to a closely related subject. I don't think I did this in the talk because the time was too limited. The alchemists also used the signs of the zodiac because there could be more propitious days than others. If you did certain experiment on certain time of the year and related to the zodiac, you know, under Pisces or whatever, you might have a better luck of doing what you were trying to do, which of course was transmute metals. And so the signs of the zodiac appear on the floor, set in stone or in other forms in old laboratories. And in Germany, I believe it's in the Munich Museum, which is an absolutely marvelous museum. Fab, I could spend 2 weeks there. There is a reproduced alchemical laboratory, quite authentic. I say authentic as if I knew. Nobody was there. But and it has the circle with the 12 circles around it, like a clock, in the floor. As I remember, it's a long time since I've been there. Well, that appeared in some pictures. And Dad decided, when Dad made up his mind about some of these things, that was it. There was no changing it. And he decided, you know, pink is gray. It's gray. There's no question about it. All the world is wrong. It's gray. And he decided that that was this alchemist symbol for the laboratory. That was his own, because of course the alchemists used symbols. There was a symbol for silver and a symbol for gold and a symbol for sulfuric acid and the like. So nobody could persuade him that that was not true. So we adopted, the company adopted, the sign of the zodiac, the circle with 12 circles around it, and the letter F in the middle, Fisher, as the logo of the company. Today, they have dropped the outer circles and kept the center circle. And that's where it came from. That's what they dropped.
I didn't know that.
The guys with sense of humor in the company said, they'd knock the meatballs off around the outside. That's what they did. They knocked the 12 meatballs off around the circle and ended up with the inner circle with the F. The F is, I changed the F twice to keep in style, because lettering has style.
Yes, absolutely.
It goes in vogue and out.
Absolutely.
I changed it a couple times. I think what they're now using is pretty close to something I figured out way back. But that's where the circle came from, and that's where Dad got the idea. I came back to the alchemy lab. Now, as I said,
if the paintings and engravings weren't actually in your home, how young were you when you started visiting your dad?
You'd go down to see Dad for some reason or other downtown. You'd meet Dad in his office because maybe Mother was coming in town to have dinner with Dad, or the whole family was going to have dinner at the Duquesne Club, which is a downtown club here. And so you'd stop in his office while Mother waited. I don't recollect it. I never, to my recollection, never saw her go in the office. I don't think in her entire life she ever was in Dad's office. Mm. You've got to remember, she was born in 1881, and she comes into the 1900s from a completely different century. Women stayed home, took care of the house, raised the children. Women, of course, there weren't any women in the office in 1900 either. You did typing pools were all men. Oh no, it was World War I that put women in the office, and that was 1917, 1918. After that, women were in the office. It became telephone operators and typists and clerks and all kinds of things. So Mother never came. I don't think in her life Mother ever came into the office. But I would come into the office and visit Dad, who was just, I'd be right with you, Jamie, as I was calling, cleaning up his desk, sit down. And I can remember looking around, and there were alchemical pictures there, but they were scattered all over the building. All kinds of alchemical pictures. And a lot of stuff in files, because he, as I said, Dad collected on the theme. Did it have any interest? Did it have any historical connection? Didn't matter. It was fine work or
right.
not.
There's so many engravings, portraits, and
copies,
apparatus, and
photographs.
Many of them are fine old engravings. Yeah,
that's right.
Many.
And copies of engravings.
Yes.
And photographs of engravings.
And the engravings are copies of the art of the painting.
Of the painting.
Before, right. Which is very important historically.
So. It was. You can see filing cabinets, really filing cabinets full of stuff, which you couldn't see. But Dad had a whole bunch of filing cabinets.
Did he sometimes show them to you? Like,
well, he'd show.
A
visitor would come, and maybe by appointment. We didn't get a lot of visitors in those days until we built the museum, and that was my baby. I said, we can make a whole lot more out of this collection, in terms of. I was then became vice president of marketing, and I was thinking of all kinds of ways. And I said, we were doing some reconstruction in addition to the building. In 1946, we built an addition to the building. And I went to Aiken, and I said, let's do this. We're going to have to build a new cafeteria. We have way outgrown the other one. And while we're talking about plans for this new building, which is bigger than all the other buildings we've already built in downtown Pittsburgh, why don't we think about a little private dining room and a place for the collection. And he said, what do you mean the collection? I said, well, let's make a kind of a museum. Let's pick 20 or 30 items, of which we have dozens and dozens and dozens, and hang them in a style that is really very high class. Like, everybody thinks more of artwork if you go into a beautiful art museum that has marble than you would have if the same things were hanging in the barn. Same art.
Absolutely. But context is everything.
Exactly. And then we could invite people to come and visit our museum And it'd be a real goodwill thing. We could also take him through our building and show him our computer system. We were just getting computers at that time.
Uh-huh.
If they have time, we'll run them up to a big factory just built in Indiana County, which is near Pittsburgh. Except, well, they said he'd like to think big. And he thought, well, boy, that's, you know, you give him a big idea, he liked that. He would grab onto a big idea. So he said, go ahead. So we built this museum, and we built a little room attached to it. And attached to that was the kitchen, which served the cafeteria, but it was a complete modern kitchen. So you could get the bigwigs to come in. The purchasing guy or the chief chemist or some company. And the salesman would come in with him because, of course, they had waiting time and airport time and they became real buddy-buddy. And you had people you were pretty chubby with. And they would be met by a car. We'd arrange and they'd come in. And we would have a look at the museum, at the pictures, and we'd explain what they were, and that was very impressive. And broke all the rules about serving sherry. You didn't want to get into booze, and you didn't want to get into cocktails in the middle of the day, and you didn't red or white wine and all this sort of stuff. So I hit upon the idea, why don't we have a couple of good bottles of sherry? They lasted a long time. I bought some little wee glasses and a
very
nice tray,
parlor-like.
Silver-plated tray. These were classic.
Yeah.
They have that sitting in a table in the middle of the museum. These people would come in from Indianapolis and Dubuque and Detroit and Minneapolis and God knows where. And they were ushered in, and this, we had this other idea that whoever was in town of Aiken, Ben, and me, and sometimes it was all three, and sometimes it was just two, it depended. If you were in town, you got a notice way in advance as to who was coming in, and the company, and a little bit of the financial background and how our sales were, who the competitor was, a little digest of the situation, which you could read in about 3 minutes. So in comes the guy, and he would have the sherry, see the picture, step through the door, all walnut, have a very nice one plate lunch served in the private dining room. And the dining room was a memorial to Louis Pasteur, the French chemist who was dead, was a great supporter of. I mean, he was an extraordinary man. Everybody knows about him. And so, and we would tell about him while we were sitting there at lunch.
Right.
And then we'd get the subject around to the company's, the customer's company, and he was just, his mind was blown, because here was the president of the company, two senior vice presidents of the company, who knew the facts and dates and that, how much business we bought, who the competitors were, all about his company. And then if he went to our Indiana plant, which is a huge factory, and then drove to the airport, he would get a, I mean, these guys never got home. It became a standard one-day package. And people became just, I mean, they never stopped talking about it. I mean, there was just nobody else in the business after that. They were just swamped.
Wonderful.
It was a very clever act. Now that was, you see, using the pictures in a very discreet, measured, high-class way.
Yes.
He wasn't thrown at him. It was.
Yes.
It was Fisher Collection. It just happened to be in our building.
Yes.
And the Pasteur room was a totally non-commercial. It was a memorial to this great French chemist.
Right.
And I mean, that's not commercial. That's,
it made them feel so good about their profession.
Yeah, especially if they're scientists.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a coup, and we carried that on for years and years and years. And the Allied company came and bought it. There was a, it was out by then, but there was a very tough talking and tough man named Hennessy, who was the boss, the ruthless boss of Allied Corporation. And he bought this company thinking it was something it wasn't, because he told somebody else, using some very foul language I won't repeat.
You mean in buying Fisher?
He thought he had bought A, and he ended up buying B. Not that, I don't think that my brothers defrauded him, he said, I'll clean it up a little bit. He said, I believed all the propaganda and stuff that that damn Jim Fisher wrote in his catalogs. Because he had the impression that we manufactured everything, because we had 5,000 Fisher brand items we didn't make. He's Fisher brand. So he was in a big hurry for everything. Uh-huh. Everybody was buying high-tech companies. He thought he was buying some dot-com company or something. So after he'd made a visit to the company and was met by John Pavlik, who wore a white shirt and was all shined up, and they cleaned the building, and a tour through the building was arranged, and he swept through the building like royalty. They took him down, headed to the private dining room. And on the way there, where he was to have a bite of lunch, followed by his accolades, ring bearers, and geez, well, got to the door of the Fisher Collection, which he had bought. That was the mistake I mentioned. And opened the door.